Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The first order of business, as everyone knows, is always to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman. Bierman. Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson, excused. Pryor.
Present.
Quam. Ryer.
Present.
Schultz. Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. Okay, next order of business is approval of the minutes of April 6th. Representative Bonner.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from April 6th, 2021.
All right, thank you, Representative Bonner. Moving approval of the minutes of April 6th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So members, we are back on House File 2128, and it was laid over at the end of our last meeting. So I'm just going to pick that bill back up, figuratively at least, virtually. And the amendment that we're working on, which is the DE1 amendment to House File 2128. And today we have quite a few testifiers who are going to testify on various parts of our bill. And then after today, of course, we have our amendment deadline tomorrow, and then we'll be taking up the bill for markup to, in other words, to take up amendments and vote on the final bill on Friday. So that's where we're going. So we now have a very good, healthy list, I would say, of testifiers. I'm really excited to hear from everyone. And, you know, just so everyone knows, I do listen as hard as I can. I take notes. I hope that other members are too. I expect that they are. And I do want to say, before I go to testifiers, we're going to somewhat take folks in the order of the bill. I think we've asked people to stay within 2 minutes because we do have quite a few testifiers. One thing I would like to say that's a bit different is if we have testifiers who are paid lobbyists, always they do tell us who they're representing when they come before us, but I would also ask them to disclose any other client they have who might have an interest in the topic that is being discussed. So I think that's really important because sometimes I've found later on that a lobbyist was actually representing more than one of the parties who were before us testifying. And it is, I think, important for us to know who exactly we're hearing from. So if the lobbying community would please make that disclosure, we would appreciate it. And there may not be anybody here that needs to, I don't know. So with that, first person on the list to testify on Article 1 is Jennifer DeCobellis. Ms. DeCobellis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As mentioned, my name is Jennifer DeCobellis. I'm the CEO of Hennepin Healthcare System, and I'm really optimistic to see the many proposals in this bill that will improve the lives of the people we serve at Hennepin Healthcare, both in the metro and across the entire state, including the extension of Medicaid for postpartum mothers, telehealth, and periodontal coverage, to name just a few. In addition, I'd like to express our deep gratitude to Chair Liebling and all the members of this committee for including House File 1609, the Medicaid Directed Payments Proposal, in your omnibus bill. This proposal will allow Hennepin Healthcare, our state safety net health system, to access a new form of federal payments. This new payment will provide support to our majority Medicaid health system and ensure that we can continue to provide exceptional care for all Minnesotans. We also want to thank DHS for their technical support as we have walked through the complexities of this financing. This bill will allow us to shore up the state's safety net health system into the future. So we're here just to thank you again for your commitment to keeping care accessible for individuals on public programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, next we have Dominic McQuarrie. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. I'm Dominic McQuarrie, Director of Public Policy and Community Relations at the Wilder Foundation. No other clients, just happy to be here with Wilder. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 2128. At Wilder, we recognize how the health of our loved ones impacts our own physical and mental health, and that's why we focus on whole family approaches as the best ways to serve our clients. So we'd like to thank the committee for the inclusion of not just one proposal, but a package of proposals that target our system of prenatal, childbirth, and postpartum care, focused on both parents and children with a specific eye towards racial disparities that exist in the BIPOC community. These include the Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancy Program, support for the African-American Babies Coalition, and the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act, and the extension of the MA eligibility for new moms to 180 days. I do hope that as we continue through the process of this session, that eligibility will be extended to 365 days made allowable in the American Rescue Plan. Additionally, as a provider of behavioral health services, concerned about our overall workforce shortage and lack of access to culturally appropriate care, we thank the inclusion of the two appropriation items that were included in Representative Vang's House File 970, and these will complete the package that's also in House File 2127, Chair Schultz's bill. Lastly, I'd like to thank the committee for the work done related to telehealth, specifically the inclusion of audio only as an eligible service. We fully support the need for clients to determine the best mode of care for their health and support the proposals to continue to study the impact and efficacy of the different modes of telehealth in coming years, but do like that this bill does include that as an allowable service based on our experience during the pandemic and allowing us to better serve our clients. So thank you for your time and have a great day.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Okay, next on the list, we are moving to Kenza Hajmusa. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kenza Hajmusa, and I'm the Public Affairs Director of Take Action Minnesota. We're a multiracial grassroots organization. Our members have worked on healthcare issues for the last 15 years, prioritizing a public healthcare system that leaves nobody out. We strongly support Article 1, Section 66, that develops the proposal for a Minnesota care public option. This provision lays the groundwork for a true public option rather than a product that is public in name only. It ensures the state has the information, infrastructure, and federal support needed to implement a public option as soon as possible. We also support the MCO study to support a healthcare delivery system that puts people over profits and addresses health disparities. We are deeply disappointed that critical components of House File 11 were not included in this omnibus bill. So many undocumented Minnesotans have been on the front lines through this pandemic and have suffered the consequences. We know that EMA is not sufficient, and denying people health care coverage, especially during a pandemic, violates our core values as Minnesotans. We ask that provisions in House File 11 are restored to remove barriers to Minnesota care and fix the Minnesota care family glitch. In addition to these provisions in Article 1, we strongly support proposals in this bill that lower drug costs, including limiting price gouging, flat copayment provisions, and House File 8 that allows the state to use its purchasing power to lower prescription drug costs for the state. We support extending MA postpartum coverage to 6 months, provisions to improve maternal health outcomes, especially for Black women and women of color. And lastly, thank you for making birth control prescription payments copay free and 12 months in length. Thank you for all of your work on this bill. We strongly support it.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Bentley Graves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm going to provide some testimony on the public option proposal in Article 1, the frozen formulary proposal in Article 5, and the telehealth proposal in Article 7. We've long shared our concerns about any move toward a public option, and we do so again today. The design of a government-run public option centers on payments to healthcare providers that are significantly less than what's paid by private commercial insurance. This will lead to significant financial impacts on providers and hospitals and to increased costs for those with private coverage because healthcare providers will be forced to shift even more costs to these Minnesotans. These changes will only lead to increased instability in the commercial health insurance market and would threaten the continued viability of the individual and small group markets in particular. And these concerns about stability in the individual market are heightened further by the fact that the bill doesn't continue reinsurance or provide any other stability mechanism for that market. As it relates to the frozen formulary, while the goal of these proposals has merit, the real-world impact is often increased costs associated with prescription drug benefits. Fiscal notes have provided varying cost estimates for different proposals over the years, but it's important to note that the provisions included in this bill avoided a state cost because it sets a different standard for state public programs than what's required in the commercial market. Under this bill, four times a year, state public programs would still be able to make the kinds of changes to formularies that limit program costs that would no longer be allowed in the commercial market. With regard to telehealth, we've advocated for clear guardrails around care provided via telephone, clarity in statute to ensure that care delivered via remote patient monitoring isn't subject to the state's rules requiring payment parity, and clear language to ensure that value-based payment arrangements that leverage telehealth as a means to ensure better health outcomes for patients aren't negatively impacted by payment parity. We've also maintained that the bill should not unnecessarily limit the use of incentives like lower out-of-pocket costs that encourage someone with health insurance to get care via telehealth when it makes sense to do so. We appreciate the fact that the language in this bill addresses our concerns related to telephone calls or remote patient monitoring, but we are concerned that the bill limits flexibility in plan design and encourages the use of telehealth when appropriate. We're also concerned that it does not provide clarity around the intersection of telehealth and value-based payment arrangements. And finally, as it relates to as is the case with the bill's frozen formulary provisions, this sets a different standard for state public programs in the commercial market by sunsetting telehealth expansions for public programs in July 2013, but continuing them permanently in the commercial market. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And next we have Alita Borut. Welcome. Oh, and we can't hear you. There we go.
Thank you. The Land Stewardship Project, which I represent, has thousands of households in rural Minnesota, and the main issue for our members is healthcare, both cost and disappearing provider access. Rural Minnesota has few large employers offering healthcare benefits, and fewer still offer affordable family coverage. Most plans purchased this year through MinSure are high deductible or catastrophic plans. Out-of-pocket costs create a steep barrier to care. We strongly supported the Minnesota Care Public Option with low copays and deductibles, affordable family plans, coverage for undocumented residents, and options for our Main Street businesses and farms. People argue a public option would hurt rural providers. Well, the Minnesota Hospital Association just reported that nearly all hospitals in Minnesota face low profit margins due to debt from patients on high deductible plans, plus declining reimbursement by commercial payers. Article 1, Sections 43 and 62 importantly ask DHS to report provider reimbursement rates under managed care plans and to explore alternate payment methods in our public programs. Transparency is needed to ensure optimal use of precious healthcare funding and fair reimbursement to medical providers. Article 1, Section 66 instructs DHS to deliver the analysis and proposal we need to explore a real solution to this crisis, a public option so every Minnesotan in every zip code can access the care they need. Thank you all so much for your work.
Thank you very much, Dr. Borut. And Dr. Borut, you didn't actually say your name for the record, and I know I said it, but could you just say your name for the record?
Yes, sorry, it's Alita Borut.
All right, thank you so much. Okay, next we have Kevin Brown. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Brown, owner of SmartSet, a 35-year-old printing company in Minneapolis. We are a certified B Corp and union shop, and I serve on the advisory board of Main Street Alliance of Minnesota, which represents values-based small business owners from across the state. We support the public option sections of the bill, Section 62 and 66, to provide more access to affordable health insurance. The status quo is not working for small business owners and our employees. Too many small business owners go without health insurance because they simply can't afford it. Many would-be entrepreneurs don't take the leap to start their own businesses for this reason alone. Small businesses are at a competitive disadvantage in the current system. Offering health insurance as a benefit is critical to hiring and retaining skilled workers. Workers that I compete for directly with large corporations like Target, who pay a fraction of what it costs me for small group insurance. Many small businesses can't afford to provide health insurance to their staff, or they keep workers on a part-time status in order to avoid costly benefits. My company's expenses for healthcare premiums account for more than $4 for every employee hour worked, with annual increases of 10 to 20% every year. This is simply not sustainable and very much limits the wages I can pay. If you care about helping small businesses, please support these two steps to further develop a public option proposal that includes small businesses and to deliver care in the most effective way possible. We hope that the department will prioritize and consult with all who lack access to affordable coverage now, including people of color, low-income residents, and small business owners. In addition, it is critical that we amend the bill to expand coverage for undocumented immigrants who are small business owners and employees. We must also remove the family glitch, harmful to many small business owners who rely on a spouse's employer coverage. As the pandemic has shown, we cannot afford to leave anyone out. Both of these issues are urgent and cannot wait. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. So we're going to move on now to the next group of testifiers. And I was told after I gave my little pitch in the beginning to, about the paid lobbying community that, of course, many of the people weren't in the room yet. So they didn't hear that. And so people are coming in stages today because we have so many people testifying. So I would just repeat, and I don't know if this applies to any of the folks who are going to be testifying now, but I'm just asking people who are paid lobbyists, if you represent any other party who would have interest in the matter being discussed, to please disclose that as well as the one that you're here representing. So probably no one in the room right now has that apply to them, but just in case. So next up is Sarah Durr. Welcome, Dr. Durr.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sarah Durr, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I am testifying today on behalf of all Minnesota Pharmacy and the Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance. Thank you to the committee for your work this year to recognize that Minnesota Pharmacy is forging ahead to provide many critical healthcare needs for patients, as well as modernizing and expanding our ability to serve Minnesota patients through telehealth and other cutting-edge services. You also recognize that many Minnesota pharmacies are in trouble, and we appreciate that HF 2128 recognizes that reimbursing pharmacies for less than their cost to dispense a medication is unsustainable. Minnesota pharmacies are critical healthcare access points for all Minnesotans. Minnesota Pharmacy thanks you and the legislature for adopting 2 weeks ago a Medicare reimbursement rate for COVID-19 vaccine administration. Today, we want you to know that we support the provisions in HF 2128 that will expand access and reduce the cost of healthcare for Minnesotans by providing greater drug pricing transparency and regulation. We support your committee's omnibus bill budget legislation provisions that will move the management of MA prescription drugs dispensing to a fee-for-service pharmacy benefit model. However, at a time when Minnesota leads the nation in pharmacy closures and more than 30% of independent pharmacies have closed in Minnesota over the past decade, critical access to pharmacy care services for Minnesota patients is in jeopardy. Unfortunately, the legislature will not act this session to address the constant and increasing unsustainable prices practices happening daily with the pharmacy benefit managers. We appreciate Representative Bolden's efforts to try to address these unfair, unsustainable, and detrimental PBM reimbursement practices, but understand that the remedy and legislation to help address this will need to occur over the summer and the fall outside of session. Today, I want to thank the committee for recognizing that the administration's recommended pharmacy reimbursement rate for the MA and the governor's budget would have reimbursed pharmacies below cost. However, HF 2128 leaves in place a reimbursement rate of 1048 for MA, which is also not sustainable and would reduce a majority of Minnesota pharmacies, reimburse majority of Minnesota pharmacies at a lower cost. We urge the committee to adopt the department's own cost of dispensing survey reimbursement rate for MA prescriptions dispensed at a rate of 1077. While 29 cents per prescription may not seem consequential, that does add up. The Minnesota Dispensing Cost of Survey recently completed by Mercer concluded that the median cost to dispense a Medicaid prescription in Minnesota is 1077. Pharmacies across Minnesota that work with MA patients every day need to be adequately and sustainably reimbursed at cost for their dispensing prescription medications. Your legislative colleagues in the Senate have included MA reimbursement rate for pharmacy dispensing at 1077 in their Health and Human Services Omnibus Finance Bill, and I urge you to do the same. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much, Dr. Durr. Mary Krinke, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I am a paid lobbyist for only the Minnesota Hospital Association and work there. So given the time constraints today, I will provide oral comments on three priority issues. Article 1, Section 24, MHA opposes this new language creating a reporting mandate on entities that are deemed by the federal government to be eligible to participate in the 340B drug discount program. These entities include all critical access hospitals and the safety net hospitals. We would have to report what we pay, what that we pay for all drugs, as well as what we get reimbursed for all drugs, both in and outside of the 340B program. This will be a burdensome task and seems particularly intrusive outside of our public programs. Section 42 is MHA is opposed to carving out the outpatient prescription prepaid outpatient prescription drug benefit from the prepaid medical assistance program and moving that to the fee-for-service program. This will result in a significant loss of payments to our 340B hospitals. The federal government intended for 340B hospitals to receive these payments to better serve low-income patients and the communities. If enacted, DHS will also be sharing any savings with the federal government. The last area I would like to comment on is Article 7, the telehealth portion, and we appreciate this being in the omnibus bill. Unfortunately, Section 29 contains a sunset on all the public program waivers on July 1, 2023, except for the provision allowing the home to be an originating site for telehealth services. We would urge that this sunset be deleted from the bill to give healthcare providers and medical assistance enrollees the assurances that these expanded telehealth services will not be pulled away from them. Please don't put the onus on trying to pass legislation to restore these services. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Mr. Euland.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland. I'm the Associate Vice President of Public Affairs at UCARE, a health plan serving more than 550,000 members in Minnesota. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm testifying in opposition to the proposals to carve out non-emergency medical transportation, dental, and pharmacy benefits from the health plans. We oppose each of these carve-outs for policy reasons that have been detailed in a letter that was sent to the committee. One core policy concern is that these carve-outs will lead to further fragmentation of care, especially for some of the vulnerable populations that we serve. Care coordination is a key component of what a health plan provides for the highest risk and vulnerable populations. Health plans provide significant outreach and care coordination for dental, for example, as a way to help to find a dentist. Moving to a single administrator does not solve the core funding issue, and there is no assurances that moving to a single administrator will increase access for members. UCARE currently offers a mobile dental clinic in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Dental School as a way to increase access for our members, and this would be lost under a single administrator. The pharmacy carve-out is also a major concern from a care coordination perspective. Our care coordinators are able to access pharmacy data in real time to identify issues for our members and help prompt action to have prescriptions either refilled or identify safety issues. It is not clear if DHS will be able to transmit this data to the health plans in real time. Our members can't afford to wait days or weeks for this data to be transmitted to address some of these care coordination issues. The council also opposes the transportation being handled by a single administrator. Minnesota health plans were some of the first in the country years ago to pilot a transportation benefit. We have worked with our providers to establish robust transportation networks that are culturally sensitive to the members that we serve, and we just don't believe that a one-size-fits-all approach will meet our members' needs. In closing, the council would appreciate having additional detail and fiscal notes supporting the estimated cost savings of the DHS proposals for carve-outs, and we want to make sure that we understand the impact of the current law relating to payment delays and withholds and how they interact with these proposals. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Uland. Okay. Next we have Danielle Robertshaw. Welcome.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Danielle Robertshaw, and I'm a physician and the medical director of Healthcare for the Homeless, which is a clinic network and a street medicine team that focuses on caring for people experiencing homelessness in shelters, homeless service sites, and encampments in Hennepin County. First, I'd like to offer our gratitude for the inclusion of HF 1609, a bill that will allow new federal payments to our safety net health system. Thank you for recognizing this need and our role in supporting patients on Medicaid. At Hennepin Healthcare, nearly one in five of our primary care patients on Medicaid are experiencing housing instability. And I've worked with people experiencing homelessness for over 20 years. I was incredibly disheartened to see that recuperative care was again for the third year not included in the omnibus bill this session, and I'm asking you to please reconsider. My colleagues both in the metro and across the state struggle daily when our patients who have no safe place to go discharge from the hospital. Patients are often staying in the hospital days or weeks beyond when it's medically necessary, and if they leave without a place to go, they often return in far worse condition with infections or exacerbated conditions that create more problems for their lives and far greater costs for our systems. Please imagine recovering from the flu, COVID, or surgery without a clean bed to sleep in, a place to use the bathroom, or rest comfortably. You're forced to carry your belongings around with you all day, including your wound care supplies or medications, and likely you don't know where your next meal will come from. HF 256 would make recuperative care for people experiencing homelessness a health home model under the ACA. A health home focuses on higher need, higher cost Medicaid populations like people experiencing homelessness. It's a model that integrates physical and behavioral health, and a recuperative care health home model will allow health systems to partner with shelter and housing systems to discharge patients experiencing homelessness to a safe and recuperative environment where they have 24/7 access to beds and receive vital wraparound services while they recuperate. There's support from health systems across the state that are interested in developing these services under Medicaid. But new Medicaid services require planning. Recuperative care will require a planning of rates, services, and eligibility. The $200,000 fiscal note this year will draw down another $200,000 available from the ACA specifically for this purpose. Once designed, Minnesota will be able to request that Medicaid payment for recuperative care services statewide as it does in other states. Recuperative care is a much more effective and cost-efficient way we can prevent this revolving door. Decades of research have shown the cost-effectiveness and improved outcomes of recuperative care. We can show that decreased hospital length of stay, post-discharge emergency department visits, 911 calls, and rehospitalizations. The costs we currently incur for this revolving door far exceed the $200,000 cost of this bill. I see too many patients with nowhere to go once they leave the hospital. Please make this investment this year so we can take the first step in making recuperative care a reality in Minnesota. Thank you for your time today and for all your efforts to build this budget.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Robertshaw. Okay, now we're going to move to a different topic under Article 1. And I know that we've just had a new group of folks join us. I don't know if any of the folks who are going to be testifying now are lobbyists, but I'm just going to repeat my request that if you are a paid lobbyist and you are telling us who you're representing, that you also tell us if you represent any other clients who would also have interest in the topic. So with that, we're going to go to Rose Schaffhauser. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rose Schaffhauser, and I'm the Executive Director for the Midwest Association for Medical Equipment Services, known as MAMES, that represents DME providers in Minnesota and seven other states. Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity to testify on DME Article Number 1. The purpose of my testimony is to provide an overview that the proposed budget cuts to DME will most likely end up costing more money than the projected savings for the following reasons. First, Medicaid is already paying Medicare rates except for a handful of items considered complex medical equipment and supplies, such as enteral nutrition and specialized feeding tubes. Second is a related items that do not have Medicare allowables. There are two extreme cuts proposed. One is for items that are miscellaneous coded, such as complex rehab accessories for wheelchairs would be reimbursed at provider's acquisition cost plus 10%. The second is for items Medicare does not cover that Medicaid does, such as incontinence supplies, seat elevators for power wheelchairs, compression garments, et cetera, that would be reimbursed at provider's acquisition cost plus 20%. This legislation assumes that acquisition cost is the only cost, when in fact, according to studies, it is only 58% of the overall cost. This methodology does not take into consideration what goes into providing these items, such as where the Medicaid beneficiary lives. Providers are not able to charge for delivery, shipping, and setup, and those costs alone are tremendous, especially servicing rural Minnesotans. Providers must also be available 24/7, have licensed and trained staff to set up and provide complex wheelchairs, respiratory, feeding supplies, and so on. What is most horrendous about the cost-plus methodology is what happens to access. When reimbursement rates do not cover costs, providers most likely will not carry these items. I have seen our providers eliminate entire product lines where they could no longer afford to carry them if they wanted to keep their doors open. In closing, Mames asked the committee to recognize that Medicaid is already paying Medicare rates for most all DME and that no further savings would be obtained without threatening access. In addition, there are zero savings included in the budget relating to acquisition cost plus methodology. So why would the state risk moving forward through such a dramatic and drastic proposal that surely will impact patient lives? If we have learned anything about this pandemic is what makes treatment at home rather than in the hospital more important than ever. Our providers are crucial in making home care possible, and any further cuts to Medicaid will continue to decimate the number of providers in our state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Myrna K. Peterson.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to share my story. This is personal. I've been in a wheelchair for 26 years now. My quality of life depends on my the durable medical equipment. Without it, I would be really limited to my abilities. I live in a very small assisted living. Without them, I would end up in a larger facility, which would be even more costly. I use the PureWick equipment, which is an external catheter for my incontinence at nighttime, quadriplegic from the neck down. Tell everyone I only have one thumb that works, but I have a mouth that won't quit. And I also sit on the Minnesota Council for Disability, representing Deeds Region 3. I have a real obligation to speak for other people other than myself to provide a good quality of life without these, without access to this durable medical equipment. The cost is prohibitive. Most of us are on very limited income and cannot afford anything out of our personal, so we would do without. Without the exercise equipment that I can have in my own home, I would lose, and I would be one of a number in a larger facility. So for the sake of quality of life, we must keep the budget intact for medical durable equipment. Thank you so much for listening and everything you do to support people with different abilities.
Thank you very much, Ms. Peterson. Appreciate your testimony. Christine Langto.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi, my name is Christine Langto, and I am, probably losing you. I am the mother of a son who received special services. I don't have any fancy titles. I am a respiratory care practitioner with 23 years of ICU experience. So my conversation today would be about how it impacts my son and others like him. I think that when we look at being fiscally responsible and making budget cuts, we also have to look at a little more detail to the items that are being proposed to be cut, such as customized trach tubes. Customized trach tubes, customized wheelchairs, things that are customized for people. It's not like they're picking out a fancy red car instead of the blue plain car. Customization refers to their body anatomy, what they need, what keeps them safe. A customized wheelchair that keeps them from falling out. My son's customized wheelchair allowed him to go to work. So from being homebound and staying at home, it allowed him to have a job and be interactive in the community. We went a period of time where we couldn't get his customized trachs. I, as a respiratory therapist, thought, I can fix this problem. I'll get to the right doctor. We'll get by without that trach. Three doctor visits, didn't work, couldn't find one. And ultimately, the one that he had in fell apart, which therefore then required another doctor visit and an OR visit, so to have it surgically removed and replaced with another custom trach. So sometimes saving costs on one end doesn't really save money on the other end, not to mention the trauma that causes to the patients themselves. So I guess my request would be to be fiscally responsible and yet really look at some of the items that we could save but not save on. Last week we wanted one of our items repaired. They told us that they couldn't give us the $200 part to repair it, but if we called our doctor's office and got an order, we could get a new one for $1,800. That is not fiscal responsibility to me. So I am always grateful and thankful for the things we get, and I think there is always room for improvement, but I think we need to be really cautious as to where we go with these budget cuts and how they really impact people. So I guess to that, that's about it. Otherwise, I'd ramble on. So I'll say thank you very much for this opportunity to be here today.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Langto. Nathan Mayer. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Nathan Mayer, and I'm a recent graduate from the University of Minnesota. I'm currently a user experience designer at a Fortune 500 company, and I also represent the United States in the sport of soccer. What I'm about to say may be unexpected because of those credentials and society standards, but I also have a physical disability, spinal muscular atrophy. From day one, I'm again told that I would not be a contributing member to society only because of my disability. When I was diagnosed at the age of 8 months, my parents and I were told that I wouldn't live past the age of 2. From that day forward, I've taken every obstacle and taken it as a challenge to overcome, which is why I'm able to be here with you today with a college education and living a life that nobody expected me to. None of that would have been possible without the help of medical equipment and assistive technology. That same medical equipment that is being proposed to add budget cuts. Everyone here, if you have a disability or not, desires to be independent. With having a disability, they require a little more assistance than normal, but that desire for independence is still there. I use many pieces of medical equipment, including a power chair, a special formula with mixed supplements for nutrition, and many other pieces of assistive technology, all to help me be a contributing member to society. And that hasn't been easy. Going through life has not been easy with a disability for me or my family. But this equipment and technology has allowed me to go through life a little easier and not have to think about how hard life can be without this equipment. My family doesn't have that kind of money to afford this type of equipment. Not many families do. And we're here today because you're looking to cut some of those programs and funding to help relieve the struggle of life with a disability. And trust me, I understand the want to save funding. I took a couple of college classes on business, but this is a matter of people's lives and how these cuts are going to make it more difficult for families and individuals to thrive in spite of the situation. I close with this. My entire life, it was easy for others to not think outside the box, and that's many things with disabilities. It's easy to think that people with disabilities don't need or want things like everybody else. I don't do easy. I embrace a challenge and move forward regardless of my disability. And I ask you to do the same. People with disabilities can contribute to society and be like everyone else. We just may need some help with equipment for that. Please don't make life harder for people with disabilities than it already is in regards to getting this equipment. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We really appreciate that you're here with us today. Thank you for telling us your story, and congratulations on your graduation and your other achievements. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. I don't know if Tammy Zilka was able to join us. Ms. Zilka? Okay, not seeing her. Okay, I think we're going to Ann St. Martin. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Please go, just say your name and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann St. Martin, and I live in Invergrove Heights with my family. I am a parent and an advocate. I'm testifying today in opposition to the DME rate reform provision proposed by the Blue Ribbon Commission and now included in the HHS Omnibus Bill. This harmful provision will limit access to vital resources needed for complex medical kids like my son, Leo. My husband, Dennis, and I have two sons, Joe and Leo. Joe is 6 and Leo is 4. Leo was born with a rare genetic disease called Pompe disease. Leo's body cannot break down glycogen, which then stores up in his muscles and his heart, causing deterioration, muscle weakness, respiratory failure, cardiomyopathy, and a list of many other things. Throughout his life, Leo has received support from quite a few different home care services: weekly enzyme replacement therapy, monthly respiratory visits to check his trach and ventilator, and nutritional support. That's not even close to the full list of services Leo has received in his 4 short years of life. He is a very complex patient, but at the end of the day, he is still a 4-year-old little boy who loves baseball, golf, and playing with his brother. He wants to be like any other kid his age, but of course there are limitations to what he can do. I feel it is my job as a mother of a complex child to limit those obstacles. The ability to be nimble and adjust the supplies to fit Leo's needs is one of the reasons children like him can succeed at home. The DME rate reform provision in the Omnibus Bill moves all the DME rates to a Medicare fee schedule and reduces access to medically necessary equipment and supplies that are specific for caring for children. Equipment that is good for aging adults is not always best for medically complex kids. For Leo, these special supplies are custom trach tubes for smaller airways, smaller gastrostomy tubes, and special nutritional supplements. These items keep Leo healthy, they keep him out of the hospital, and they help him live within his community. I'm asking for protection on reimbursement for these specialized DME products. If these products are reduced to Medicare reimbursement levels, suppliers would not be able to afford to provide them at a significant loss. Think of it as an investment in these kids' healthy futures and their ability to not need as much Medicaid support as they get older. Leo is Medicaid, so just because something works for an 88-year-old does not mean it will work for our complex little humans. For the state, the desire to save money in these uncertain times is understandable. But should it be done by sacrificing our medically complex children's needs? Please protect the items that are essential to allowing our children the freedom to live at home and participate within our community. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. St. Martin. Appreciate you being with us today. We are now going to turn to talking about I think, the dental provisions in Article 1. And I know we have a new group of folks, so just going to repeat, if anybody is a paid lobbyist and you have another client who would have an interest in the thing you're talking about, please just let us know that as well. I know you all tell us who you represent, but sometimes we don't know that you also represent other people if you do. And I'm not sure anybody does who's going to testify now. I'm just saying that to everybody who's coming before us today. So first on the list then is Dr. Siri Fiebiger. I hope I said that right.
You did. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Siri Fiebiger, and I'm a practicing OBGYN and here today actually representing the Minnesota section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, also known as ACOG. I'm here to thank you and your entire committee for including a number of vital provisions. First, thank you for including Representative Richardson's Dignity in Pregnancy Act, which will require hospital-based obstetrical care and birth centers to provide continuing education on anti-racism and implicit bias. Inequities in health and in healthcare are pervasive and continue to plague our healthcare system despite increasing recognition among patients and providers of their existence. Structural racism in reproductive healthcare has been well documented and is reflected by inequitable access, biased care, and significantly poor outcomes for women of color. Thank you for including this important legislation. Right. Secondly, ACOG is also very thankful for the extension of Medicaid for postpartum care within your bill. While our organization, both nationally and here in Minnesota, have been advocating for a 12-month extension due to increased numbers of chronically ill moms and wherein one-third of maternal deaths occur, we are grateful that thousands of new Minnesota mothers will not be kicked off of their health insurance 60 days after giving birth. We also want to thank Representative Kelly Morrison for continuing to champion this really important legislation. And lastly, thank you for including another of Representative Morrison's bills, House File 520, which requires coverage of contraceptives and contraceptive services with no co-pays or cost sharing. It is vital for all women to have timely access to the medications they need when making decisions about their reproductive health. Again, thank you for allowing me to testify and for supporting these important provisions to improve the health and the lives of our patients. I'm happy to entertain any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Fiebiger. Appreciate your testimony today. Next on my list is Jean Larson. Welcome, Ms. Larson.
Good afternoon. I'm Jean Larson, director of Northern Dental Access Center, a nonprofit critical access dental provider delivering dental care and patient support services to 10,000 low-income people each year from over 20 counties in rural northwest Minnesota. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Oral Health Alliance, a coalition of critical access dental providers who provide dental care and support services to low-income children and families across Minnesota. First, we are pleased to see included language that restores coverage for periodontal disease. The absence of this over the years has caused needless tooth loss among our patients. We are also pleased that this bill contains the development of a dental home concept. We believe the dental home is the most efficient and effective approach to delivering comprehensive dental care to underserved populations. We do request that the bill language be aligned with the dental home language contained in Representative Ryer's House File 1918. We believe that language includes the stakeholder engagement necessary to ensure that pilot projects are inclusive, culturally appropriate, and successful. Our Oral Health Alliance has significant concerns with the rate reform and single administrator proposals contained in this bill. While there is not time to go into detail, we are very concerned that any repeal of the Critical Access Dental Program jeopardizes the fiscal solvency of safety net dental providers. Regarding the proposed rate reform, it is encouraging to move from a 1989 fee schedule, but we simply have not had enough time to analyze the financial impact of the proposal on our current fee-for-service patients, and we're reasonably confident it would be problematic if all Minnesota healthcare plans were reimbursed as provided in the bill. Lastly, Under the current structure, most, if not all, managed care and county-based purchasing organizations reimburse us at higher rates than those paid by DHS. We oppose a single administrator because we value the diversity, responsiveness, and investments these payers provide to our organizations and to our patients. I thank you for the time to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Larson. Okay, let's see. Karen Kleinhans, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Kleinhans, and I am the CEO of Community Dental Care, which is one of the largest critical access providers in Minnesota. We are a nonprofit dental clinic providing comprehensive dental care to 50,000 unique patients of all ages per year in four clinics in the Twin Cities and Rochester, Minnesota. We also provide outreach services in 40 locations, including schools, community-based not-for-profits. About half of our patients are children, and 83% of our patients are on Medicaid, and the remaining 17% are half of those are uninsured. All of our 40 dentists and 30 hygienists are employed by us on either a full-time or part-time basis, and we employ a total of 225 people across our locations. I'm testifying today on two oral health provisions in your omnibus bill. First, thank you for including House File 838, authored by Representative Bierman, which adds back the periodontal coverage to the adult benefit set. This is a much needed benefit and will keep our patients with chronic conditions, including gum disease, healthier and less likely to have complications that require hospitalization. Second, I know that a proposal to carve out the Medicaid dental program has been controversial, and while I don't know if a carve-out is at all the best solution, but I would like lawmakers to understand that our organization is in serious financial peril due to the fact that current reimbursement rates are inadequate to cover our costs. These rates make it impossible for us to even approach the market wages for clinical staff, and thus we have trouble recruiting and retaining staff to serve the thousands of patients who rely on us for fundamental care. In addition, all other expense categories rise each year, while the reimbursement rate has been mostly stagnant. A recent analysis of our own fees collected by code has brought to light the fact that the reimbursement rates we are getting from HMOs are at or below the rates that we are getting from DHS Medicaid fee-for-service. This surprised me because I expected the rates from the HMO payers to be higher than the DHS payments. And the fact that this is even happening is partially related to the fact that we do not have a transparent system for rates, and it seems to allow payers to pay different rates to different providers. Community dental care, as one of the largest CAD providers in the state, cannot survive being paid at or below DHS fee-for-service rates. Whether the proposal to carve out the dental program passes or not, we need transparency in this system. And we need fair and equitable rates that keeps organizations like ours able to function and serve the patients who need us. There needs to be a floor on what providers are paid to treat Minnesota healthcare program enrollees that does not allow payers to go below that. And I thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to testify, and I'm available for any questions.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Dr. Keith Mays, welcome.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Keith Mays. I serve as the interim dean of the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. The dental reform proposal contained in HF 2128 proposes a repeal of critical access dollars, rural access, and children's rate enhancements. This specifically runs the risk of jeopardizing the fiscal solvency of safety net providers, such as the School of Dentistry. The School of Dentistry contains both an educational program and a clinical enterprise. This clinical enterprise functions as a safety net dental clinic. The dental clinic has an educational model that provides opportunities for students to learn how to engage with and serve various at-risk populations, some of whom are at an increased risk of experiencing health disparities. These populations include immigrant and refugee populations, individuals with disabilities, older Minnesotans, low-income children, low-income families, and BIPOC Minnesotans. This educational training is important because oral health is associated with overall health, and therefore access to oral health care is important to every Minnesotan. The School of Dentistry educates and trains approximately 72% of Minnesota's dentists. Approximately 30% of the school's revenue is generated by our teaching clinics. Approximately 40% of the patients cared for within the School of Dentistry dental clinics are covered by Minnesota public programs, making us one of the state's largest public program dental providers. The revenue generated from critical access dollars supports the commitment of the University of Minnesota to serve its citizens. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. May. We appreciate your testimony. Dr. Mays, I'm sorry, I left the S off there. Okay. Dr. Helgeson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Liebling, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Michael Helgeson, and I'm the CEO of Appletree Dental, another one of Minnesota's largest critical access dental providers. Today, I'm speaking on behalf of Dental Access Partners, which includes Community Dental Care, Appletree, and Hennepin Health's Dental Department. Thank you for allowing me to testify regarding the oral health provisions of your omnibus bill. First, I want to thank you for including House File 838, authored by Representative Bierman, which adds back periodontal coverage, which is just so important for thousands and thousands of Medicaid enrollees with chronic conditions such as diabetes. It will help keep them healthier. We're hopeful that this will be funded this year and are confident that it will actually save taxpayer dollars in the years to come. Second, we want to comment on DHS's new dental reimbursement model, modifying the governor's initial proposal. DHS's new model would rebase 1989 reimbursement rates to 2018, and we strongly support rebasing rates to the current century. I think that's one thing everybody can agree on. The full impact of DHS's updated model is currently being analyzed by dental providers, as you've heard in other testimony, that have been working together for more than a year developing the dental home approach that you've also heard about. Until further analysis can be completed, it's unclear whether the proposal can be fully supported. While we do understand DHS's desire to reduce the gap between CAD and non-CAD providers, we remain strongly opposed to the complete elimination of CAD, of the CAD program, before a new reimbursement model has been created based on the dental home dental demonstration projects. We do truly want to get to yes with the legislature and DHS, and are now working on a compromise that we hope will help achieve everyone's goals. So again, thank you, Representative Liebling, for being a tireless supporter of oral health. And we also want to thank Representative Bierman and Representative Breyer for getting so deeply involved in dental policy as well. I would welcome any questions. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Helgeson, and thanks for all your work over the years on this topic. Okay, we're going to move on now to Waleed Sonbal, I hope I said your name right. And
yes, you have. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. As I said, my name is Waleed Sonbal. I'm the owner of Blue and White Taxi. We are a large NEMT provider where we do anywhere between 1,500 to 2,000 rides a day. 95% of our owner-operators and drivers are from multi-generational community of color and immigrant communities. I'm just here to testify about the NEMT transportation part, for I have concerns about it only because I don't really understand where the savings are coming from, and I've asked and I haven't been able to been guided to that. I see that, for example, the rate structure has been stricken, and that worries me that the drivers and owner operators that are making money, as a living, will see their wages drop or their income drop from something like this. There's also talk of a single administrator, and that does worry me. I have business operations in other states, and my partners and I have always agreed that working with local MCOs here on transportation has been far better than working with single administrators in other states. For example, one of the MCOs here at one point had contracted one of the large single administrators out to do their customer service. And we were getting rides from people from Minneapolis to go to Duluth. And we were getting rides, and we had to keep on saying no to them because it just wasn't economically feasible to do something like that. And so we worry about stuff like that because then we become the gatekeepers of trying to prevent fraud. And more worrisome is that a lot of these large administrators who aren't based here, your community people don't understand it, and it becomes arguments we don't need to have. I understand there is a need for savings. I just would ask that, you know, either be looked at properly, because I always think that there's more efficient, better ways, and I really don't see how it is here. I think that the quality of care that's being provided right now, especially through the pandemic, has been great, and I don't know if this change is really the best time for with all the questions that we see.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Sonball. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right. Turning to another topic now, we're in more or less in Article 3. And just to be clear, we're not requiring people to stick to the article, but just kind of trying to group things for members to understand what's going on here a little bit. So the next testifier is Megan Remark. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Megan Remark, and I'm the president of Regents Hospital. I'm here today to testify on the section of the omnibus bill related to Regents Hospital bed licenses. First of all, thank you for including the additional bed licenses for Regents legislation that was authored by Representative Herr with many co-authors and no opposition. Regents Hospital is the only level one adult and pediatric trauma and burn center in the East Metro, and we care for many patients that can't be treated in other hospitals. Regents provides more charity care than all other hospitals in the East Metro combined. These new beds are incredibly important because Regents is running at higher than optimal occupancy rates for a level one trauma center, which needs to have capacity to flex up in the event of mass casualty events or pandemics. We also know that the state is in need of additional mental health bed capacity. With these new licenses, we will be able to add 20 new inpatient mental health beds this fall, significantly faster than our original plans to bring those beds online in 2025. We do have concerns about the provision which requires Regents to stop using revenue recapture. We use revenue recapture as a last resort, and we have put in place safeguards above and beyond what is required by statute to protect our most economically vulnerable patients. But in order to continue carrying out our safety net mission in a sustainable way, we really need the ability to collect unpaid medical debts from individuals that have the financial resources to pay for them. There are over 150 other healthcare entities in the state that were granted the ability to use revenue recapture to help address the large amount of uncompensated care that they face. I hope you will take a comprehensive look at the issue of uncompensated care before you remove this tool that many safety net providers use to carry out their mission. Thank you for your consideration and for the inclusion of needed capacity for patients to receive hospital care in the East Metro and surrounding communities. And I look forward to more conversations with you about how to support our safety net in a sustainable way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Remark. Sue Abdeholden, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abdeholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. As we have talked about before, people are boarding in the emergency rooms for days or traveling hundreds of miles to access inpatient psychiatric care. There is a severe shortage of beds, and we are likely to lose more beds in the future. While hospitals are private, often nonprofit entities, they are also a community asset. Under the ACA, they are required to survey the community about the needs and meet them. And mental health, of course, always comes up in the top three. And yet we aren't seeing an investment to meet the needs. So NAMI supports having public hearings before there are major changes to the services provided by a hospital so that the community has an opportunity to respond. The second issue that's important in this bill is to make it easier to add inpatient psych beds by creating an exception to the public review process for any hospital that has an ER and is not a psych-only hospital. Originally, we had meant for the constraints to the exception to be just for adult inpatient care, which is why we had the word adult on line 190.29. It was perhaps not well written, and I will take responsibility for that. We know that right now, one of the few places that would be willing to add children's inpatient psych beds is Prairie Care. I'm not sure we would want to build a new psych-only hospital in the future, even for children, but if we made an exception for an existing children's psych-only hospital, we could allow Prairie Care to add more beds to meet the incredible need that we are experiencing right now. This provision could also help hospitals in rural areas because the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003 actually allows critical access hospitals to add psych beds and not have them count towards their limit of 25 beds. I want to add that we do support Regents Hospital expanding beds because we need more psych beds, especially in the metro area. Just a couple of other items I'd like to add in the few minutes I have left is that we support including the funding for the Loan Forgiveness Program and the CEUs, paying for CEUs so BIPOC mental health professionals can become supervisors. We support expanding the Medicaid coverage for pregnant women from 60 to 180 days. We support expanding coverage for the non-surgical treatment of periodontal disease. Many people with mental illness have dry mouth from the medications, and it's a huge issue. We do support allowing payment for the monthly public transit passes under NEMT, an issue that, as you know, I had worked many years on. We do support requiring information on managed care plan reimbursement rates, especially for mental health. I think some sunshine on that would be helpful. Also making drug formularies available 30 days before the renewal date and not removing drugs during the contract period is very important for people with mental illnesses. The timely provider credentialing is also important at a time when we have workforce shortages. We don't want to have to wait for months to get new providers on board. And we also support the promotion and continuation of telehealth. That's been very important. The telephonic help has actually been really helpful for people with mental illnesses who, frankly, may not have, because of their income, access to other types of devices. And so it's something I know you have an end date on there, but I do want us to make sure that we look at that and not just kind of forget that there's an end date to that. And lastly, we support the ID card for homeless youth that will really make it much easier for them. So thank you so much for your work on this bill. We really support it. We think you have some really great things in there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Afterholden. Appreciate your testimony, as always. Asfia Kadir, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling, committee members. Special thank you for Megan Remark and Sue Aberholden for your advocacy. Today, I'll introduce myself, Asfia Kadir, board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist representing Prairie Care. I'm testifying today about the hospital moratorium provision in Article 3, Section 45, beginning at line 190.26. While this provision expedites the process by which hospitals can add psychiatric beds, it specifically excludes Prairie Care. Prairie Care is the only Minnesota hospital that has demonstrated a sustained commitment over time to expanding psychiatric beds for youth. In the last decade alone, Prairie Care has added 71 beds, more than all other Minnesota hospitals combined. Earlier this year, Prairie Care made the decision to add an additional 30 beds to meet the need in our communities, reeling from the epidemic of teen suicide and the pandemic. As we meet today, there are several patients in our ERs across the state awaiting beds, and there are only 3 beds available. In this time of need, Prairie Care is poised and ready to add beds. Based on the current bill before you, these beds would not be available for use until the summer of 2023. That is a systemic delay in crisis resources. Allowing Prairie Care to take advantage of the expedited process contained in the bill would move the availability of these beds up by a full year, allowing us to reach an additional 1,170 patients. I can testify that the number of young people that die by suicide for lack of access to care is an unspoken epidemic, but it is life-changing for their families. Thank you for your recognition that the hospital moratorium needs to be modified. I ask that you amend the bill to allow Prairie Care to add needed beds on an expedited basis, like every other hospital. We have been working with Representative Fisher on this, and he has language ready that would eliminate this disparity. I trust that this committee will deliberate in earnest and make provision for the most vulnerable among us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we're on to Natlita Gorpusumu. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and members of the committee. My name is Natlita Gorpusumu. I'm the outreach coordinator at the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. The Children's Defense Fund Minnesota is committed to ensuring every Minnesota child has a healthy head, fair, safe, and moral start in life and a successful passage to adulthood with the help of caring families and communities. For this reason, we thank you for taking an aggressive, multifaceted approach to addressing Minnesota's appalling maternal and infant health disparities in the House Omnibus Health Bill. Important provisions include expansion of Medicaid postpartum, funding for the Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancy Programs and the African American Babies Coalition, and dignity in childbirth training and other elements. We know the life outcomes of every child began to take shape before they're born and are influenced by one's experiences and relationships. Yet in Minnesota, healthy pregnancies and births are less common amongst Black, American Indian, and rural women, regardless of income and education, thus creating disparities that can last a lifetime. We also appreciate the healthcare delivery reform study and Minnesota Care public option proposals, as they're critical to our ability to move forward in future years to ensure greater health insurance coverage for all children and their parents. Allowing DHS and others to work on these pieces outside of the legislative session and in consultation with the Biden administration would be incredibly valuable as we consider public coverage expansion in future years. We hope future negotiations would include discussions about healthcare coverage and other assistance for undocumented families. Thank you for your work to advance a budget that gives all children a great start and ensures a bright future for them in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
All right, well, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate you being here today. Okay, we're going to move now, I think, into Article 5, although, as I say, we're not limiting anyone to that article. But so I think we have a bunch of people who've just entered, and I just would repeat my request to anyone who's a paid lobbyist here representing a client that if you represent other clients who would also have an interest in this topic that you're here to talk about, that you just simply let us know that that is the case. So first up is Dave Renner. Welcome, Mr. Renner.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. My name is Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association, today also testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians and the Minnesota Academy of Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Just a full disclosure, in addition, the MA does provide some legislative work also for the Minnesota Orthopedic Society, the Minnesota Academy of Otolaryngology, and the Minnesota Chapter of the American College of Physicians, all specialty society physicians.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
I first want to just thank the members and the chair for the work in this bill and how it's really focused to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to affordable coverage and care. One of the pillars of the MMA's mission is to ensure that Minnesotans are the healthiest in the nation, and we think access and affordability is critical. I'm going to focus on just four key provisions in today's bill, and they're not all in this article. I apologize. MMA wants to thank the committee for the language in Article 1, Section 16 that does expand postpartum coverage up to 180 days. As you've heard from others, that's a critical time, and it's a time we really appreciate the expansion. CMS does now allow coverage up to 1 year, and we know there's budget challenges, but we hope that the state will continue to move forward, and hopefully we will get to expanding that to 365 days. Second, I do want to comment on the public option language. It's in Article 1, Section 66. This is an issue that has been discussed for many years, and we believe the language in the bill will help, is a movement in the right direction, so that the commissioner is directed to perform actuarial and financial analysis for any public options and help to, will help policymakers to better understand the fiscal impact. We would encourage additional language to be included to also look at issues related to reimbursement models and reimbursement rates, because we think we also have to balance the sustainability for providers as well. The MMA is also beginning to work, and one of the focuses we will have this coming year within our association is looking at different options to ensure affordable coverage. So we look forward to participating in the discussions coming forward on that. The third area is I want to mention is on Article 5, Section 8, and this is the language that's included that limits insurers and PBMs from forcing an enrollee who's using a medication that is currently working to change that drug during their contract year. This is, again, legislation that's been around for many years. These forced changes many times, most times, are not done necessarily because the drug is better for the patient, but it's because the PBM has received a better deal or a better rebate from the manufacturer. Many times enrollees will choose their health plan based on the drug they cover that is covered for them, yet months into their contract, all of a sudden that's changed on them and they can't get out of the contract. We think insurers should also be bound to the contract to provide those coverages. And then finally, I want to thank the committee and the chair for including the expanded coverage for telehealth and telephone visits in Article 7. As you've heard from others today already, telehealth has been, we have all realized how well it can work for patients and how much patients really benefit from it. We are a little frustrated, however, and disappointed to see that the language for coverage for public programs is sunset on July 1 of 2023. We would encourage the committee to work to remove this if at all possible. But as I think Ms. Adler-Holden just reminded the committee, let's not forget this, because clearly if we are interested in addressing health disparities, we believe telephone and telehealth coverage must be covered for our public programs as well. Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the chance.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Renner. Dan Andreessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Just going to raise concerns with the language here in Article 5, former Representative Cantrell's language on restricting formulary changes. Our plans strive to make few changes to a formulary throughout the plan year. And for our plans in the fully insured market, these changes are rare. But if they do happen, it's likely because a drug manufacturer has decided to unexpectedly increase their prices in the middle of the year. The language in Article 5 will likely increase future health insurance premiums because the bill doesn't address the root cause of the issue, which is the ever-increasing prices of prescription drugs. A similar bill to this language, House File 58, was heard in this committee on March 5th. That bill included language to freeze drug prices throughout the year, but this was not included in the omnibus bill, and we would urge its addition. Lastly, I do want to highlight for the committee that the language, as was mentioned, is not being applied equally to state public programs, as there will be a different standard for this population. Starting on line 256.26, the definition of enrollee contract term is being used to define the period of time the formulary cannot be changed. For commercial plans only in the fully insured market, that term is 12 months. For medical assistance in Minnesota care, that term is a calendar quarter or 3 months. This means if you enroll in MA or in Minnesota care product, DHS can change your drug formulary coverage, your drug coverage, 4 times a year or every 3 months. The language in the omnibus bill should apply equally to all Minnesotans, regardless if you seek your care in the fully insured market or through a state public program due to income, age, or disability. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Matt Schaefer, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I'm the Government Relations Director for Medica, a nonprofit Minnesota-based health plan serving members in 9 states, although today I'm testifying in capacity as a member of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'd like to get our concerns on record about Article 5, Sections 7, 9, 12, 13, and 22. The Council has testified on these individual bills as they made it through the committee process, so in the interest of time, I will speak to our broader concerns about drug prices as well as the new language. As members know, healthcare spending makes up about 18% of our GDP, and drug prices are the fastest growing piece of that growing pie. Now, the medicine the drug manufacturers make is saving lives, and it's giving us more time with our loved ones that we otherwise wouldn't have had. However, the problem is some of these medications are pretty expensive. and that's resulting in higher premiums and higher out-of-pocket costs for Minnesotans. And we're concerned that if the concessions I mentioned become law, Minnesotans will see their out-of-pocket costs go up faster. Speaking specifically to Article 5, Section 9, the language looks like proponents are seeking to respond to concerns that were expressed before in committee, and we do appreciate that. Unfortunately, we still have some operational concerns, and the bill does still exempt both CGIP as well as those state public programs that serve the elderly, disabled, and the poor. That remains a concern to us. Our recommendation would be to consider deleting sections 9, 12, and 13 and change section 22 to reflect a study that focuses on replicating the success that we had in driving up generic prescription use over brand name products and applying a similar approach to prescribing more biosimilars over biologics. We recommend that if we take some time, we study it, and we make sure we get it right before we roll it out, we'll have a better outcome. That concludes my remarks. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Schaefer. Michelle Mack, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a director at PCMA. PCMA represents America's PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers. PCMA appreciates the opportunity to testify on the DE1 to House File 2128 and is opposed to Article 5, Sections 8 through 13, 16, and 21 to 22. I will focus on the provisions found in Article 5, Sections 11 and 8 that deal with the point of sale rebates and frozen formulary, wherein the underlying bills did not have a hearing this year. I have submitted written testimony on the other provisions. Article 5, Section 11 requires that rebates negotiated by PBMs on behalf of health plan sponsors be applied to a patient's cost sharing at the point of sale. The language is a one-size-fits-all mandate that will do little to address the increasing price of drugs and will only serve as a windfall to drug manufacturers. A key way PBMs help consumers obtain lower prices for prescription drugs is through the negotiation of rebates with drug manufacturers. Rebates are typically used to keep costs down across the board as employers and other plan sponsors use the savings from rebates to lower premiums for everyone. When considering mandatory point of sale rebates, it is important to keep in mind that rebates have consistently been shown to save consumers money. Recently, CMS found that a federal proposal for point of sale rebates in Medicare Part D would increase premiums by up to 25% and increase drug spending by $196 billion. Also, mandatory point of sale rebates under that federal proposal would provide drug manufacturers a windfall of $40 to $100 billion. Finally, point of sale rebates won't help the majority of patients who take generics or lower cost drugs. By disrupting competition in the prescription drug market, mandatory point-of-sale rebates ultimately will increase the prices that we all pay for healthcare and prescription drugs. Relative to Article 5, Section 8 that deals with frozen formulary and will restrict our ability to put downward pressure on manufacturers to limit the increase of prescription drug costs. A recent report by Milliman shows that this type of policy would cost Minnesota healthcare payers $75 million over 5 years, and the state's own analysis of a similar bill this year substantiates this. In closing, PCMA believes that all these sections, individually and collectively, raise prescription drug costs as they remove important tools that PBMs use to deliver high-quality services. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Alex Sommer, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Alex Sommer, and I represent Prime Therapeutics, a Twin Cities-based pharmacy benefit manager owned by 18 not-for-profit Blue Cross and Blue Shield health insurers, including Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. This bill has a number of provisions that will raise prescription drug costs for Minnesotans. Specifically, we have concerns with Article 1, Sections 10, 24, 44, and 64, and then Article 5, Sections 8 through 13, 16, 21, and 22. In my written testimony, I've touched on each of these sections and our reasons for concern. In my 2 minutes today, I want to focus on the cost implications of these sections in total and this legislature's tacit acknowledgement that these costs are not worth any speculative benefits proffered by proponents of these sections. The first legislative maneuver in this bill is an exclusion of Medicaid and Minnesota care plans from the expensive mandates it aims to place on private health insurers. In Article 5, Section 9, the same workaround is used to exclude CGIP, or the state employee plan. These mandates will still cost money. They will still raise the cost of prescription drugs, just not for the state. And where there is supposed parity and applicability, such as with frozen formulary in Article 5, Sections 8 and 21, there's still a workaround where the state-funded plans can do the very thing this bill would prohibit private payers from doing. In that example, managed care plans and county-based purchasing plans can still make formulary changes 4 times per year based on defining enrollee contract terms differently, which was mentioned previously. If nothing else, we believe private payers should be allowed the same options to manage ever-rising prescription drug prices as the state programs. Absent that, we project a $20 million per year impact to our Blue Cross and Blue Shield Minnesota business, with that number rising each and every year after that. Next, we have concerns with the inclusion of certain sections that were not before this legislature until this week, through choosing bill language that died in previous sessions or including new language altogether. With frozen formulary, House File 58 was introduced and discussed on many occasions with Representative Elkins throughout this session. His bill attempted a holistic solution, but the underlying concept is an expensive one. His language was eschewed in favor of a bill that died in the 2020 session that will be just as, if not more, expensive than House File 58. And in the case of point-of-sale rebates, another costly provision as detailed by Ms. Mack before me, this concept has not been discussed at all in 2021. To reiterate, this bill will be costly for Minnesotans and Minnesota employers. The lack of a fiscal impact driven by a carve-out of state-funded plans does not change that fact. We respectfully oppose the previously mentioned sections and look forward to further working with the committee. And I thank you for your time today and look forward to answering any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you very much. So, members, before we go on to the next testifier, I'm just going to mention that we're going to extend our time until 4:40. So we have 15 minutes left in this hearing. And I'm hoping that we can get through our next, I think, 5 testifiers. So I'm going to ask everyone to please stick to the 2-minute limit if you can. Do it if at all humanly possible. So let's see. Jewellian Jackson is next. I'm not seeing Jewellian Jackson. So let's go on to Lynn Nelson. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nelson, Director of Legislative Affairs at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Blue Cross is the largest nonprofit health plan in Minnesota, covering 2.8 million members in all 87 counties. My comments today are on behalf of Blue Cross and the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I want to thank the committee for including the cigarette tax dedication to tobacco prevention and treatment that was in Representative Morton's House File 572 that is being carried in the tax bill. This investment will save lives and reduce youth addiction. The focus of the remainder of my comments are in Article 7. We appreciate Representative Morrison's leadership on this issue, and the council supports 90% of the language in Article 7, but want to raise concerns and urge reconsideration of language mandating that all telehealth visits be paid at a level equivalent to that of an in-office visit. Significant consumer and health system benefits have resulted from the pandemic's movement to telehealth. For Blue Cross of Minnesota, we processed 65,000 claims for telehealth in all of 2019. In 2020, that number jumped to 3 million. While there are current short-term provisions in place for telehealth, a long-term sustainable solution is necessary. The solution must allow increased access, driving toward the triple aim of improving quality and affordability, while allowing for the flexibility for changing technologies and payment options. These temporary provisions have been vital for consumer safety and access. And in fact, Blue Cross has voluntarily extended these provisions until the end of 2021 to ensure that providers, and more importantly, consumers, have certainty of that access. The future is about proactive versus reactive care, paying for outcomes versus paying for volume. As we move forward with more value-based agreements with providers in Minnesota, our hope is that we will move forward together to meet consumers' needs in telehealth. We urge consideration for flexibility and payment parity so that telehealth may ultimately support the value and outcomes provided to consumers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Dan Dwight.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Dwight. I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership. That is the only organization that I work for or represent. Thank you very much for including the telehealth provision in the bill. We continue to have a few concerns with the language in the bill, but look forward to working with you on it. We do encourage the continued use and expansion of the use of value-based care arrangements, and would like to see more of that. You know, it's been incredible how telehealth has really helped us through this pandemic, and would like to see its continued operation. But we need to make sure we get it right. Technology is evolving, And so we look forward to working with you on that as we go forward. The other issue in the bill that I'd like to highlight today, there's a few, but the big ones are the public option. We still support market-based approaches to this, and we worry about the loss of access for people, especially in greater Minnesota, as more cost shifting happens and providers have to make up the difference somewhere. So those are my two big things. I'll keep it short. I will submit some written testimony to the committee, but I appreciate the time, Madam Chair, and stand ready for questions. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Cascaden, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm delighted to be with you today, and it's fun to see the capital behind you, Representative Liebling. I'm here today representing the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, the Local Public Health Association, and the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. So these are the professional organizations and the organizations that county boards and counties all support. We really appreciate so many provisions in this bill that you have, that you're advancing. And I'm going to really focus my comments on just three articles, Article 1, Article 7, and Article 8. You will have already received written testimony from the Local Public Health Association and from MAXA and AMC and MICA. You have things in writing from them already. So counties really learned a lot. There was some silver linings to the pandemic over the last year. And among the things that we learned is that there are better ways to provide quality services and access to services. And we really have worked with you in the past about some of the waivers that were passed last year that we really saw improving the delivery of service to people, particularly in greater Minnesota, but also for anyone who has transportation issues. It's simply better. So we think there are some best practices that came out of our experience with the pandemic and the way that waivers and modifications that the Department of Human Services provided. We would like to see a lot of them continue, but we focused on four. And three of those waivers were our top, four of those of our top priority waivers are in this bill. Three of them are in Article 7, and the fourth is in the House Human Services bill. We really appreciate your support for those positions. Here's what they do. They would allow individuals to apply and attend orientation remotely if they're applying for MFIP. They would allow certain MIN choices reassessments to be conducted remotely. And they would allow for certain targeted case management visits to be conducted remotely. And we just have found that this just really provides better access, and it's more efficient overall as well. In Article 7, there is a provision that increases the allowable telehealth visits, and we support that article as well. We also learned through the pandemic about the importance of public health and our relationship of local public health to the state health agency. And we also know that that we need both local and state public health to assess and respond. We've had to do a lot of adaptation, collaboration with community partners, so that we could reduce the impact of the COVID epidemic. And so, but we also have learned that we need greater investments into our public health systems. I read an article recently that showed across the nation that public health has had a 22% reduction in funding over the last 10 years. And I'm sad to say our state has followed that pattern. But in Article 8, you have a provision that would start to reinstate some of those investments into local public health. And the local public health grant from the state of Minnesota is the state's main investment in the local public health system. Otherwise, it's county levy. And if you're in a county of 3,500, your capacity to fund local public health is very different than a county like mine with 160,000 people. So we really thank you for that funding increase. We really appreciate the funding for public health infrastructure at the state and local level. And we urge you to use some of the American Recovery Act recovery funds that you'll be getting to further strengthen local public health. I would like to flag one section of the bill that does concern us, and that's in Article 1, Section 33. We're concerned about the inclusion of a provision related to early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment services. It's often referred to as child and teen checkups. The proposed change in that article would shift responsibility for outreach for 50% of those on Medicaid or Medicare to integrated health partnerships. And our local public health people really believe that we are better positioned to do that outreach work to reach the children who are in
hello.
Are in
hello. This is actually this is Julene Jackson.
Could you someone else is speaking. Thank you. Go ahead. And Commissioner, I have to ask you to wrap up as well.
And so. I am done. That was it, Madam Chair. So thank you for your attention, and I'm sure you're going to go on to the next speaker. Thank you so
much. All right. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Appreciate you being here and for all your work. Ms. Jackson, we can squeeze you in if you can speak really quickly for us. Thank you.
I was trying.
Sorry, this technology is not always wonderful, but please go ahead, tell us your name and who you represent and give us your testimony. We just have a very few minutes left in the hearing and we have one other person.
Oh.
Can you hear me? Just please go ahead.
Oh, actually, it's Julene Jackson and I was trying to give my testimony, but there was someone else that was also speaking, so I wasn't sure what was going on.
Go ahead now.
Oh, okay. It's Julene Jackson. I was the immediate chair for the Community University Healthcare Center, but there was someone else who was also speaking over me, so I wasn't sure how I should proceed. So I wasn't sure if you could hear me or not.
We can. Please go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm the immediate past chair for the Community University Healthcare Center, and I'm also on Medicare, Medicaid, and also have a spend down of $300 a month, which automatically puts me behind the eight ball in terms of my healthcare. And I'm advocating that in terms of equity and equality, that there is a way, but we just need the will, and that it should be equally that we should have technology as well as suffer in terms of asthma as well as high blood pressure, and that we should have technology in place as well as telehealth with I'll just put this in writing because I'm totally discombobulated in reference to everything else that's going on behind me.
That would be excellent. Thank you. We will be happy to have that. Thank you so much for being here today. Carrie Oldfield, welcome.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Oldfield. I'll keep this brief. I am the director of the Local Public Health Association. Local public health is on the front lines every day performing core state mandated services to protect and promote the health of our communities. Just want to say thank you for your increased investment in the local public health grant. This funding is critical to helping our community health boards restore local capacity to meet state mandates, address local priorities, and relieve local tax levies. LPJ also appreciates the appropriation for a local public health equity outreach. Funding to support infrastructure at the state and local level is critical in responding to infectious disease threats like COVID-19 now and into the future. It will also enable us to reach underserved communities and address health disparities. We know there is a need for strong local public health infrastructure at the local level, and we would just seek additional clarity on how this funding would be distributed between the state and local level. We'd also like to thank you for your ongoing support of the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership, or SHIP. This program is really critical in preventing chronic disease and reducing long-term healthcare costs. We also appreciate the provision that allows for medical assistance coverage for asthma services that's included in Article 1. This will really allow our local health departments to work with families to create healthy environments and reduce asthma triggers for young people. With that, we'd also like to thank the committee for its support of increased funding for our family home visiting programs. These are crucial to give our families a healthy start. And then finally, I'd like to reiterate concerns about child and teen checkups that was mentioned earlier by Commissioner Kiskaden. Current local public health services include outreach about the importance of well-child checkups, assisting families with scheduling medical and dental appointments, and arranging transportation and interpreter services. Our local public health agencies regularly go above and beyond to provide assistance with other areas that include social determinants of health and coordinating programs at the local level.
Okay, Ms. Oldfield, I have to stop you because we're just really out of time. So thank you, and I hope you've submitted testimony. And just for members, we did get quite a few submissions in writing that were distributed to the committee. Of course, we will distribute any others that we receive. Thank you very much to all of the testifiers today. We really appreciate it. We will be meeting then on Friday and at 1 o'clock to do markup on the bill, and amendments are due at 1 o'clock tomorrow. As always, happy to have any of you reach out to me should you need to with any questions or concerns that you may have. And I'll look forward to seeing you on Friday. And with that, we are adjourned.